Hey, and welcome to FutureThinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you want to get a list of our favorite books, popular episodes, and to join our community, go to FutureThinkers.org/start. Hey everyone, welcome back to Future Thinkers. Today on the show we have Jim Rutt, complexity researcher, systems thinker, podcaster, and former key player in several technology companies. Jim was also previously the chairman of the Santa Fe Institute, where he's been involved since 2002, working in the scientific study of consciousness and evolutionary artificial intelligence. He's also one of the thinkers behind BigchainDB, the blockchain architecture startup.
In this episode, we talk about the concept of Game B, what it is and how it emerged, the idea of network attractors in complex systems like human society, and how to prepare for potential collapse scenarios in the future. To get all the links and show notes from this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/105. Get our 50-page guide on adapting to the future. Sign up at futurethinkers.org/signup.
Upgrade your mental operating system, increase your personal sovereignty, and gain deeper self-knowledge with our courses in personal evolution. Register now at courses.futurethinkers.org.
Okay, let's get started. I would say that the pattern, which is most significant to me right now, is that finally, a still small but growing number of people have started to realize that the epoch that we're in, the status quo, game A, whatever we want to call it, is coming to an end sometime in the not too distant future. Whether it's tomorrow afternoon or 2100, seems to me the writing is on the wall. We have already exceeded the carrying capacity of the Earth's ecosystem for the level of extraction and dumping that we're currently doing. And that doesn't even consider the fact that the aspiring middle classes of the developing world are ramping up very, very rapidly in their ownership of automobiles, their consumption of electricity, et cetera. And they should, and indeed they ought to by right be able to do that, right? So if we extrapolate the developed world's way of living, it by itself is probably over the sustainability line. And then we extend that to, you know, 1.3 billion people in China, 1.2 billion in India, billions more across the world. We clearly are driving the human race over a cliff. And numerous people are starting now to realize that. And it's causing some serious thinking way outside the box, right? And it's one of the reasons I fight vehemently against internet censorship. People say, oh, we can't have radicals like ISIS or neo-Nazis on the internet. I go, fuck that. They're part of the status quo, actually, right? Both ISIS and neo-Nazis are just another flavor of the same old shit. And we need to allow them to say their crap so that really radical thinkers, two examples I like to use are Jordan Hall and Daniel Schmattenberger, who are way more radical than either ISIS or neo-Nazis, have space to bring forth their ideas. And so what I'm tracking and what I hope continues is that truly radical thinking be happening way outside the box on how to define a new social operating system that's consistent with the limits of our ecosystem, and even more importantly, probably, is congruent with our nature as human beings.
Listening to those two guys, I was just finishing today listening to both of your episodes with them on your podcast, and we've had them both on our podcast, and they've provided us with a ton of content over the years, just through conversations between us and then, you know, with other people who are familiar with their work. And it's a really quite a task to parse through the information of what they're talking about and try to make sense of it as it is. The vocabulary and the complexity of language that they use is fairly difficult, I would say. And listening to you talk, I think you've fairly successfully brought it down into a simpler level, more understandable level. So I'd like to start actually asking the question, what's your relationship to these guys, as well as can you kind of unpack this idea of game A and game B?
Okay, let's start first with the relationship. Jordan Hall, formerly Greenhall, and I go back to, I don't know, about 2007 or 2008. where we met at a Santa Fe Institute Board of Trustees meeting, where he was a brand new trustee and I was a ongoing trustee. And we had a conversation afterwards that went on for maybe 4 hours. And it was like, holy shit, here's another person who's starting to see the world more or less. I mean, we still disagree a lot, but in ways that are close enough to the way I see the world that it's really worth having a deep conversation. And we continued to have ongoing conversations for a few years. And then in 2012, I finally published, you know, published, quote unquote, informally and privately, a 65-page memorandum, essentially, which became known in pregame B space as the Tome, which laid out a whole series of ideas about what comes next, right? What could save the world? Then Jordan and I and a handful of others decided naively, and as it turned out, ineffectually, to try to launch a new political party to carry these ideas forward. We created something called the Emancipation Party. And the writing on the Emancipation Party platform is brilliant. It's amazing. Unfortunately, there's something wrong with the old Emancipation Party website. And it's not accessible at the moment, but I'll see if I can get it up in the next couple of weeks. And we spent some time marketing, quote unquote, not knowing what we were doing really, got a few hundred followers. But then we analyzed the data and found something extremely interesting that, despite the fact that the founding group was a mix of millennials, Gen Xers and baby boomers, the people who were rallying to the flag of the Emancipation Party were strongly boomers. If the whole population had been boomers, we would have launched the party. Next down were Gen Xers. And then finally were millennials with essentially a zero take rate, despite considerable exposure. So we then, being, you know, business people at heart, both Jordan and I, we said, let's go do some conversations with millennials and find out what the heck the problem is here. And it became very clear that this was in 2012, early 2013, that the concept of a political party was poisonous with millennials. Even though this was utterly righteous stuff, you know, and it's amazing when I think back what we were advocating, a completely new monetary system, radical transparency in finance, what we called the citizenship wage, which was now called universal basic income, Medicare for all, end the drug wars. It was amazing, right? This is stuff that really advanced thinking millennials tend to be for, but putting it in the package of something called a political party by itself was poisonous to millennials. And so we said, all right, truthfully, we have to appeal to millennials or the whole idea is dead. And so we convened our group of 25 or 30 core people and just said, okay, what are we going to do? And Jordan came up with the idea that what we really needed to do was to still keep the idea of the political party, but create the concept of a series of on-ramps that were more cultural in their manifestation and were not labeled party or politics until much later in the process. And a guy who was part of the group named Thor Muller, we were just throwing out names, he came up with Game B, and we all go, shit, yeah, that's it, that'll work. And so this idea of the cultural on-ramp to the Emancipation Party called Game B, that was a fairly explicit repudiation of the way things are, which by definition became Game A, took off. And within a month or so, the interest in trying to think through Game B became much more of interest to the majority of the people than the party. And the party, we basically just said, forget that for the time being. We don't really know how to do a party anyway. So we then explored the Game B space for a while. The group kept growing. We continued to have face-to-face meetings in Stanton, Virginia, every 6 weeks or thereabouts. Both Jordan and I are great believers that social media and online creates mostly what we call weak links. And if you really want to build something, you have to augment those with strong links. And that means face-to-face. So whoever self-selected as the core team, which I think by the end was close to 50 people, most of them got together every 6 weeks in this little town in rural Virginia where I happen to live, and had like two and a half days of deep face-to-face jam. And it's really interesting. All those documents and many of the videos from that still exist on a Basecamp site, which I've continued to be paying the minimum bill just to keep it alive. And at some point, we might bring that back for people to archive the earliest histories of Game B. Now, this is where it gets interesting and a good lesson for the future. Sometime in mid 2013, the Game B group started to fissure and eventually broke. And it broke along basically two different dimensions. There's one key fissure. And it's interesting. I've talked to people subsequently, and they said this has happened to them again and again in radical thinking organizations. There essentially became two different points of view. One, that personal change was the first necessary step for the Game B thing to emerge. And the second faction was those who believed, and this a lot of this was inherited from the political party effort, that what mattered more were better institutions, right? Mm-hmm. Things like liquid democracy and a better monetary system.
Interesting, because this is almost like a difference between top-down or bottom-up organization, right?
Exactly, and this this is human nature. The arguments got very nasty and personal and name calling, and you know that we had to declare timeouts on a couple of people for 90 days and all that stuff. And eventually, both Jordan and I, who were vaguely though not completely on opposite sides of this issue, basically concluded, "Fuck this!" Right? This thing has become dysfunctional. It's a waste of time. And we're just going to shut down Game B as a live entity. But we did, you know, have some final communications to everybody saying, people, this disagreement seems unbridgeable at the current time. Let's take these Game B ideas out independently into the world and do something with them if we care to. And perhaps sometime in the future, we will stitch this back enough to bring it back to life. But frankly, we're all tired of this group and we're tired of this fighting. And so people have your, go about your life, take our ideas, take your ideas, because it was always a group effort, and bring them forth. And interestingly, that's actually what happened. There's numerous people who still label themselves as Game B people, who are, you know, working either to a greater or lesser degree on that. The one thing we did keep going as a very light linkage is there's a Game B group on Facebook that's publicly accessible, that is, you know, sort of very minimal place for people to, you know, post communications of what they're doing or post warnings about the coming collapse or what have you. And I think it now has couple hundred members, more than was ever members of the interior Game B group. I moved on. In particular, in 2014, I refocused my interests on cognitive science and then soon closely related artificial general intelligence, and have spent a lot of my time subsequently in those fields and have not really done a tremendous amount of thinking about the Game B world, while Jordan ended up connecting up with Daniel over business originally. They got together for a nutritional supplements business that I'm not sure of the details, but I think Daniel and his brother had started, and Jordan came in as a investor and business dude, and they realized they had a bunch of other interests in common, not just nutritional supplements. And so I would say the San Diego flavor of Game B kind of came back to life around Jordan, Daniel, and a third guy the hell's his name? Forrest Landry, who's also an amazingly smart and interesting thinker, and I hope to have on my podcast at some point. And the three of them, plus other people who they've connected in, have continued to bake game B at a increasing rate. And I would say that they are way further along than anybody else, and having taken those original spores, which were dispersed to the world in 2013, and have created something which may or may not be interesting yet. So, you know, that's my relationships with Jordan first, and then, and I've, you know, spoken obviously with Daniel many times, met him, etc. Very impressed with him. But at this point, I am not actively involved in that cooking, though I do offer myself as a sounding board, sometimes a skeptic. And to your point, I continually pound, particularly on Jordan, saying, where the fuck's the manifesto, dude? Right? This pinheaded shit I can follow. But the rest of the world is not going to sit down and listen to 3 hours of Daniel and Jordan and try to figure out what the hell all that means, yeah, right?
Where's my 3-minute explainer video?
Yeah, well, you know, being a boomer, I'm not quite so short attention span as that. But where's my 16-page written manifesto, right? One of the very earliest Emancipation Party members and Game B people, Brett Weinstein, the guy who from Evergreen State, he summed it up very nicely when we were struggling with, why the hell can't we launch a political party? And he said, we're all Thomas Jeffersons. We need to recruit some Ben Franklins. You know,
I'm not sure I know the context of that. Maybe can you explain your joke so that it's funny?
Well, it's not really. It's not exactly a joke, but it's more of an insight. In the U.S. founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison were these great thinkers. And great writers. I personally put Madison up at the highest water, even though he's less well-known than others. He's basically the one that wrote the U.S. Constitution. Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, two of the greatest documents ever written by human beings. But both of them were retiring, intellectual, introspective people. And the revolution never would have happened if it hadn't been for gregarious networkers and communicators like Ben Franklin, who was a polymath of the first water, one of the world's greatest scientists, a publicist, a writer, a womanizer of prodigious proportions. He was the ambassador of the early United States to France that helped bring France in as the ally, which actually secured our independence. So Ben Franklin was the activist that made it happen. He wasn't by any means just the thinker. So that was what it meant, that right. We had great thinking, but we didn't have communicators and activists.
You know, I'm fascinated by this difference in generations and how they're approaching these problems. And you brought up that one point about millennials being completely disinterested in the political party aspect. And my insight on that would be they'd be more interested if they had a direct say and don't want representative democracy anymore, don't feel like they get their needs met or their desires met that way. What did you find about it? It seems like you guys abandoned the Game B thing and focused on the messaging that would actually appeal to them more. But what did you find about, you know, from your perspective, better ways to connect with them rather than going this political party route?
Yeah, so just to clarify, we didn't abandon Game B. We abandoned the Emancipation Party, right? And instead went with Game B, which is that it is multi-level, and again, down to the lowest level. We always said that it had to be a network of network of networks at every scale, right? And so one of the things we found from talking with many millennials, including some really, really smart ones, is that more so than boomers, they were interested in doing things in their local communities, right? They were hands-on, less theoretical, and to your point, generally speaking, not very interested in the idea of formal representation. And which I'll give you a little sidebar here. I came to a similar view later, and you may not know this, but I have done a fair amount of writing on the topic of liquid democracy.
Oh, really?
Yes. Cool. That's a, in fact, really my document, Introduction to Liquid Democracy on Medium, is now, I think, the third or fourth highest ranked Google retrieval when you type in liquid democracy.
Huh. Interesting.
And I don't know if you guys know what liquid democracy is, but it's an idea of delegative democracy where every person has a series of proxies, which they pass off to people they trust more than themselves on given issues, but they can always retrieve those proxies and cast a vote themselves if they want to. And while at this point, liquid democracy is still conceptually too hard for most people to understand, it does resonate and is congruent with this idea that millennials do not like top-down rigid structures such as first-past-the-post representative democracy. And so while we have not formally merged, I shouldn't say we, but the San Diego faction hasn't formally merged liquid democracy into their new prescription for Game B, it's certainly something they think about and know that's out there as an alternative way that's more likely to be accessible to millennials and basically anybody who's fed up with the status quo.
Mm. So it seems like you've been kind of silent in this conversation up till recently when you started your podcast. You've kind of jumped in a bit more in the public end of the conversation. What has caused you to want to participate more on that level, and what do you hope to bring to the table?
It's interesting. The podcast idea was more or less independent of Game B. I had spent 2018 and part of 2017 writing essays, which got, you know, some decent level of attention. But I will say I am naturally not a good writer. I struggle with it. You know, to write a decent 2,200 word essay takes me weeks, right? Mm-hmm. And I was bitching about this at dinner around Christmas time with my family. And my daughter said, "Dad, you may not be a great writer, but you sure are a good talker." And she said, "You should have a podcast," right? And that planted the seed in, you know, Christmas time 2018. And I had some intentional downtime for a month in the spring of 2019. And during that time, I said, "Fuck yeah, I can do a podcast." And I listened to some of the other leading podcasts. And I said, not only can I do a podcast, but I can do a podcast at least as good as any of these other leading podcasters, right? And I bet it would be fun. And so I did, you know, I am a planner, having a person been involved with the launch of 17 venture startups as either a principal, early investor, director, or advisor. I know what it takes to make something work. So I spent, you know, several months studying how you built a podcast. And I concluded that there were no insurmountable obstacles. And I did two test interviews, episodes, to make sure that I wasn't completely inept at it. Now, the first two weren't great, but they were good enough to convince me that with natural learning curve, I would be as good as I thought I'd be, which is fucking good, right? Eventually. And I'd say I'm not there yet, but I'm at good, but not yet at fucking good. But I expect by the end of the year, I'll be really fucking good. He says immodestly, right? And by the way, for people, that's the Jim Rutt Show out there. That's my podcast. So I got to put a plug nice in segue. Here. My podcast.
On the evolution of society spectrum, what do you see as the kind of really major emergent patterns right now that kind of hint at what is to come? So where do you think that's society is going right now? Because it's changing, obviously, but in which direction?
All right. That's a great question. I would, for a much more detailed version of this, I would point people to my Medium essay, In Search of the Fifth Attractor. And that, while basically based on a talk I gave, I think in 2014 or 2015, it's a little obsolete, but still the most comprehensive version of my view of what's going on and what could go on. So here's what I believe is that from complexity science, I take the view that a given society is what we could call a basin of attraction, a whole series of forces and organizations and signaling networks that coherently hold the system more or less together. Think of it as like a marble in a bowl. And the bowl is always being shaken by events, both internal and external. The marble's always moving around, but it stays inside the bowl. However, from time to time, big shakes occur and the marble goes flying out of the bowl, right? And I think a key tenet of the thinking that myself and many other people in our circle have been doing over the last 10 years is that these shakes are getting bigger. The sides of the bowl are getting lower, actually, dealing with things like the depletion of the ecosystem. Right? Nothing spurs revolution like food shortages, mm-hmm. right? And we are not far from massive food shortages in a climatic fluctuation combined with an economic fluctuation, as an example of how the sides of the bowl, in a co-evolutionary sense, have gotten lower, and it's quite possible that the marble will go flying out. Okay, so now what happens when the marble comes flying out? In a complexity science view, at least in my version of a complexity science view, there are other incipient basins of attraction out there, which already have some actors working in them or planning for them. And to give you an example of the of some other attractors, which I believe are indeed out there, one is what I label neo-fascism. And I think the most clean example of that, despite claiming to be communist, is China, right? They're really fascists, right? They're nationalism plus dictatorship plus capitalism in a very ugly combination. However, one that in the short term, at least, can be sold as working. It's produced an economic miracle. It's produced stability in a country that for thousands of years has been racked periodically by massive chaos. So, neo-fascism is an attractor. I think we have other smaller neo-fascists out there, like Putin is a good example, right? And the current shape of Russia. Another attractor I would call neo-dark ages, which all the various forms of religious fanaticism fall into, whether it's ultra-Orthodox Judaism, whether it's Islamicist Islam, whether it's the more radical Christian identities in the United States. In my mind, they're all equally bad and all equally the same thing, which is wishing for the return to theocracy. And truthfully, there's a lot of people out there that want that. So that attractor exists, right? Mm-hmm. And under chaos, we could see the marble landing in neo-dark ages. Horrible. Third bad attractor, what I call neo-feudalism. Which is, to my view, what will you get at if radical libertarianism were to have its way? Koch brothers, Peter Thiel, those people, right? Where money becomes everything. It becomes a hierarchical structure based on wealth. With the power of modern money management, wealth is going to become much more tied in generationally, and we're going to end up with a feudal structure. And particularly as advanced AI comes in, should advanced AI be captured by capital rather than shared equally by the commonweal, they will lock in, they could lock in a neo-feudalist state where we're all driven to the edge of survival while a tiny fraction of 1% lorded over everybody, and another 10% are the equivalent of the knights of the late Middle Ages who produced feudalism. And then the fourth attractor, bad attractor, is the general one of chaos, right? One could imagine some bad combination of events, food famine plus, let's say a solar flare that knocks out power and, a number of combination of things that just break down the state rapidly. Our advanced society is hierarchical at many, many levels. Think of the levels from mining sand to the chip in your iPhone, right? There are many, many, many levels of emergent technology, and the most vulnerable of which is the electrical grid. Right. And so if chaos starts to break out in an advanced country, the first thing, many things will go. But if the grid goes, everything goes very, very rapidly. We could have a 90% die off in much of the advanced world, probably not in the U.S. because we are so overly productive in food. Even if we didn't have fertilizer, U.S. could still produce enough food for itself. But in many other countries, there would be a massive die-off. U.S. probably a 50% die-off. So the chaos attractor certainly exists. So those are the four that I say are out there. So we have neo-fascism in the form of China and Russia. We have neo-dark ages in the form of the various religious fanatics of all sorts. Let's throw the Hindus in there too. Plenty of fanatic Hindus out there. And I consider them all equally bad. You know, I have no dog in any fight for any religion. It's all horseshit, in my opinion. And if they had their way, many of them, more extreme members of them at least, would love to do a theocracy. You know, neo-feudalism, sort of radical, unhinged libertarianism and chaos. And so the fifth attractor is what we need to build, a new social operating system. And again, a social operating system is many, many pieces, including signaling systems that coherently hold together as a new bowl to hold the marble in the face of the inevitable jiggling of any high scale system. And that's what I hope people will build. And in that essay, I lay out some of the ideas of what needs to be built. And I don't prescribe what the solutions are. Though I do say that it has to be comprehensive, and here are some of the things that you might think about. And that's what I think of the San Diego tendency of Game B being, is a good faith attempt to build the fifth attractor. Whether it's the right fifth attractor, I do not yet know. I hope there are other people experimenting with the operating system of the future so that when the marble flies out of the bowl, and it will, that it has a better place to land than the four bad attractors. So that's my view of what's going on.
I'd love to dive in a little more to the fifth attractor, but this is actually kind of interesting how relevant this specific conversation is to us in the last couple of weeks, because we have been having this conversation about what a collapse scenario looks like. And, you know, even just yesterday, we were talking about a bunch of people coming back from Joe Brewer's Collapse workshop in Costa Rica, and how some of the people that attended that event had this feeling of like just
grief,
sadness. You know, how do I deal with this? And
fuck that, man. People should not go there. It so pisses me off. Assholes, right? Going to this grief and depression place is horseshit. Right? You know, maybe you have to go there for 3 days, but then you need to get mad, right? And turn it around and say, what the hell? You know, don't just sit there and mope. Do something.
Well, that's an interesting point that I want to make is a lot of people that are kind of predicting this complex systems, futures, like collapse scenario kind of stuff are predicting what happens when you combine all of these events and there's the outcome. But they're not necessarily talking about what do people do to strategize to come out of that situation if it does happen. It's just like, oh, it's inevitable. We're powerless. Nothing can be done. You know, this is the collapse of human civilization. And no one's talking about like, you know, if we're talking about the marble analogy, that kind of tip and then the recovery move, like what do we do to recover? How are we adjusting and playing a role in our own evolution? So, you know, that said, I'd love to hear more about the fifth attractor and maybe what you think is relevant in this sort of self-recovery tendency that humans and nature have.
I just wanted to interject a little bit because I think we've been talking about recovery and sustainability and how trying to find ways how to make the current system work for a very long time, many decades. And I think it's becoming quite obvious that that's just not going to work anymore. And we need to, we need to plan for a scenario where the marble does fly out of the bowl. Mm-hmm. The hell do we do then?
And that's what I'm saying is like, what do we do to actually recover?
Mm.
And there are many levels. And, you know, I've been thinking about collapse and survivalism for, I don't know, 40 years, right? And a lot of people are unsophisticated thinkers about this. And again, we'll take our complexity science perspective. One of the things we find is in most complex social systems, distribution of magnitude of events are power law distributed, which means that they're not bell curves. They have very fat tails. They're way more extreme of events than you would predict from a Gaussian or bell curve type distribution. And this applies to things like casualties in war, movements in stock prices, sizes of cities, lifespan of corporations. It's amazing. And this is one of the cutting edge areas in complexity science. Why is it that so many complex social phenomena are power law distributed? And so my first and most important take is that collapse is power law distributed. So if you think that all collapse is to utter chaos, you're almost certainly wrong. You know, to utter chaos has a larger probability than a Gaussian distribution would say, right? Because if we're in our current world, a Gaussian distribution of, say, you know, what's happened in the last 50 years would say it's almost impossible to have a full collapse. But a power law distribution might tell you there's a 1% chance, right, of a complete collapse of everything. And so I have to look at recovery, resilience, and survivalism as against an ensemble of scenarios, right? Power law distributed from a relatively modest but still big enough one for the marble to fly out of the bowl to utter and complete chaos where most urban people will end up as jerky cooked over smoking tires, right? That's certainly a possibility, right? And however, you know, because of the fact that it's a statistical distribution, fortunately, the less severe scenarios are the more likely ones, right? So again, that's another reason not to get super depressed, right? Probably 99% of the people on Earth are not going to die, though it might be the case. But, you know, we might be a scenario where 10% die or 20% or 50%, all of which are survivable. 99%, yeah, it's survivable in the very long term, but I'm not sure I really want to waste my time planning for that one. As an exemplar to punctuate the idea of how extreme things could be. We all know that the Earth was hit by a 10-kilometer wide asteroid about 66 million years ago that wiped out the dinosaurs and a bunch more, 50% of life in the ocean, et cetera. And I tell people, don't bother planning for that scenario. Just put your head between your legs and kiss your ass goodbye because it's you're done, right? If you happen to survive the initial firestorm, civilization worth living in ain't going to recover anytime soon. And so basically, you have to plan your resiliency and your recovery against a plausible set of scenarios. And, you know, so, and not over build because it costs too much, right? Mm-hmm. You know, to build a recovery and survival mechanism for the 99th percentile is more than I'm willing to contemplate doing. And on the other hand, I believe it quite likely that we will have a collapse of some sort. And so it makes a lot of sense to prepare. And my own preparation is 30 years ago, I bought a farm in a very remote place that's at the top of the watershed that has good agricultural soil, has lots of hardwood, and is embedded in a very good and intact community of people. And I will say at the time I had assessed, I was how old at that time? 35. I had assessed that there was maybe a 2% of a major social collapse in my lifetime. And while I mostly bought this property for recreational purposes, did do a little bit to make it resilient and you know, a survival stronghold for that 2% chance. Now, interestingly, 30%, 30 years later, where I'm now 65, and so my life expectancy has gone from 50 years to 20 years. I've nonetheless raised the probability of a catastrophic collapse from 2% to 20%. So the rate per year has gone up even more than that. And hence invested a bit more in making the, you know, this stronghold stronger and more capability of surviving long enough to be able to meet the rising wave as the world recovers. And, you know, I'd say I can now survive, you know, a 20-year inflection, something like that. But probably not, a, you know, certainly not a 1,000-year inflection. And so I would suggest that those who are forward-thinking should be thinking about what they do if the shit really does hit the fan, and to what degree. And but it has to be congruent with their means, right? And their means can be greater if they pool their means. I will say, for instance, part of the San Diego tendency of Game B is to be thinking about building Game B at the level of 2,500 people communities, at least as far as I understand it, that would be remote from urban areas and would have the capability to survive some level of inflection. And I would say that's a good thing.
Yeah. I think it's really useful to look at previous collapses that have happened because, you know, historically, even in recent history, we have examples to pull from. For example, I grew up in Soviet Union and then it collapsed. And there was a lot of those kinds of different attractors that you're talking about actually played out in Soviet Union. So for the first couple of years, it was chaos and anarchy and there was no government to speak of. And there was kind of just, yeah, all kinds of different things going wrong. And then there was some sort of mob emerged, and it was the new feudalism, you could say, where a lot of people got extremely rich, but most people just were horribly broke. And there was starvation and all sorts of things. And then, you know, over time, this neo-fascism emerged that is, you know, currently happening in Russia. So and also the religious extremism has increased with that simultaneously. So it's not like one of those things happens. A lot of the time it's an interplay of multiple of these things competing for their share.
Yep, absolutely. And they're embedded in each other, right? Neo-fascism in Russia has the I'm sure it's tactical. You know, Putin himself is aligned with the Orthodox hierarchy, right? It's hard to believe that Putin believes any of that horseshit, but he finds it useful, right? And so religious fanaticism in Russia is somehow interwoven and incorporated in neo-fascism. And that's, of course, going to happen in all these systems. They're not going to be pure plays, at least not initially. And I will say that I'm glad you brought that example up because the Russian collapse, Soviet collapse into the independent CIS initially and then into the independent states is at the most mild end of collapse, right? Very few people starved to death. In fact, I'm not sure, you know, any measurable number of people starved to death in the Soviet Union transition to Russia. And I use that as a rough metric for how severe a transition is. And part of that, of course, is that the transition was made in the context of only one country. The rest of the world didn't collapse. In fact, actually move forward. China was moving forward at that time. The West was moving forward. And the West could help Russia to a degree, and it did. Of course, it also exploited Russia to a degree, which it did, which unfortunately, in my view, led to Putinism, right? If we had been in more good faith and less naively trying to push neoliberalism on the Russians, Russia might have ended up in a much better place. But a kind of soft collapse in one country that led to essentially no deaths from starvation, at least, and very few deaths from police state. Yeah, Putin and his friends killed a few people, I'm sure, but you know, nothing like the Marxist-Leninist revolutions, which we know killed 100 million people in the 20th century. So that's at the baby side of a revolution. You know, at the other extreme, you know, you might put Khmer Rouge, right, mm-hmm. which killed 20% of their population. Pretty crazy. And we can get, of course, quite a bit worse than that.
Yeah. And of course, when it happens globally, there are multiple systems that are all upholding each other. And when one thing starts collapsing, another thing collapses, and then it triggers five other things to collapse. So it's a whole different magnitude of events.
Exactly. And whether, and what you say triggers five other, this is where the complex systems modeling gets into it. Let's say one thing gets triggered, let's say a truly massive financial collapse that makes the 2008, 2009 thing look like a picnic, right? By itself, it's just abstract symbols. No wealth is destroyed. I love to point this out to people. Money is an abstraction. money is not factories. Money is not skills. Money is not mines. Money is not bulldozers. Money is just an abstraction. So we could completely destroy our financial system and our monetary system and replace it with another one. And in theory, absolutely nothing would be lost. However, we also know that massive perturbations of that sort can produce all kinds of second-order effects, right? And those second-order effects could destroy factories, could destroy communication lines, could produce massive rioting across the globe as everybody's money disappears, when super hackers decide to take down the banking system at the same time. And as I said, to my mind, and might take down, several pieces of the supporting apparatus. To my mind, the one to watch is the grid. If the grid gets taken down, then we propagate out to much more major fall. We'll fall much further. As long as the grid holds together, or at least most of the grid holds together, enough of it that we can restitch the grid back together in a year or two, then advanced civilization can recover in that 5 to 20 year time frame. If we lose the grid once and for all, it may be a long while before we come back. So we have to think about propagation from one system failure to another, and a cascade of systems failures, which then summed across them all equals the depth of the collapse. And we can do some things to make the grid, for instance, more resilient. The movement to decentralized electrical power, for instance, is a huge thing. Community solar, community generation, even if it's less cost effective, buys a tremendous amount of resilience. Let's say city of Stanton, Virginia had its own generation capacity with solar and water, et cetera, and that did 40% of its electricity. In the event of a grade 5 tsunami shitstorm, we could just disconnect ourselves from the grid and operate at 40% of the electricity that we used to have. And truth of the matter is, with the fat, dumb, and lazy American lifestyle, we could get by wonderfully on 40% of the electricity we used to consume. And so strategies like that would make places considerably more resilient. And then on the more macro scale, it's, to my mind, a huge scandal that the advanced countries have not invested in redundancy for the major components of the grid as it is today. For instance, the transformers. There's probably a 0.5% per year chance that a solar flare of sufficient magnitude will come. It may be as little as 0.2% per year, but it's no less than that. A solar flare of the magnitude of the Carrington event, let me look it up when that occurred. A giant solar flare occurred right before the modern age Carrington event. 1859, a truly massive solar flare and magnetic storm happened that was so powerful that telegraph operators, which was our most advanced technology of the day, a few of them were killed by giant electrical surges that came along the transmission lines. Fires were started all over the place along transmission lines. It's estimated that that would have fried every piece of electrical equipment that was attached to the grid today, would have blown the grid out, would have exploded all the transformers. And astronomers estimate that about one in every 500 years such a thing occurs, so 0.2% per year, 20% per century that a Carrington event solar flare would occur. It would not cost all that much to build redundancy into the grid of unconnected components, and that's the key. You must have the discipline to invest, call it $100 billion, i.e. 1 year's cost of the various U.S. external wars in redundant transformers, generators, et cetera, that are not connected to anything. So then in the event that a flare does destroy everything that's connected, we can reattach these components and gradually, over a couple of years, bring the grid back. There's an example of where even nation state thinking could be far more resilient than it is today. And by the way, that would actually work in a civil collapse destruction of the grid as well, because those redundant components would make the journey back to an electrical world much faster.
So what are some of the other important factors to think about for resilience, let's say on a community level?
Well, we talked about electricity. Food, of course, is water actually is the next one, right? And this is where people need to think really hard about their infrastructure. Some water systems are pressure driven. Where the water source is much higher than the city. New York City, for instance, is a pressure-driven water system. So even if it lost electricity, it would still have water for a while at least. Other cities are not, and they have to have electricity and plenty of it to pump their water and also to treat their water. New York is actually pretty lucky in that its water source is very clean and they don't have to do any pre-treatment of their water in most cases. But many, many, many cities in the United States and around the world, the water that comes is downstream water. You know, think of New Orleans, right? They get their water out of the goddamn Mississippi River with 75 million people pissing and shitting in it upstream, right? And of course, it's flat and, you know, they don't have any pressure to push their water. New Orleans being one of the more extreme examples, without electricity, their water system dies instantly. And without water, humans die within 3 days, right? So every community should look at their water system. And if it's geographically and geometrically such that you absolutely need a lot of power, then you better build some highly redundant power supply that's disconnected from the grid that's sufficient to drive your water system. Because if your water system goes down, civil collapse will ensue in 24 hours.
Yeah.
And in 72 hours, people will be keeling over dead.
Mm-hmm. And of course, there's the second order effects where if your water is untreated or if it's not pumped properly, disease breeds, and then a lot of people die that way.
Yep. Yep. So we get you one way or the other. Either you die of thirst or you die of disease, right? Then the next circle out, of course, is food. Right. And, you know, that is why I would not want to be in a million person or above city when a medium size to large fluctuations occur. And, the typical large American city has 48 hour supply of food within the city limits, which is shocking to me. Right. But it apparently is true in places. I lived in Santa Fe, New Mexico for 10 years, and apparently there the number's even less because it's at the very end of the food distribution scheme. Now, there are larger depots of food, and in the United States in particular, being the Saudi Arabia of food, we have vast supplies of grains and livestock animals living out in the hinterlands that represent at least many months worth of food available. But as far as I know, there's no plan to mobilize that food and bring it to the city in time. So if you think the big ones come and get the fuck out of cities of million plus and probably 500,000 plus and get out to a place closer to food. At the planning level, every city ought to have a task force and one that has real authority and some budget that says, if the shit really hits the fan, how, and particularly in the U.S. and in parts of Western Europe like France, which are pretty close to agriculturally self-sufficient, that, and of course, a lot of Eastern Europe is economically, is agriculturally self-sufficient at least the survival level, if not the middle class level. I should have a plan. How do we stitch the food in the countryside to our city in the event of a level 6 fluctuation?
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember growing up in Soviet Union during the collapse, and we actually lived in the countryside, and we had our own garden, and we had our own animals that we raised for food. And there were several years where you walk into a store and there's literally nothing on the shelves, or they might have one thing like, oh, today they brought in a supply of bread, or they brought in a supply of onions that are kind of half rotting, and you don't really get much choice over what you get. And it was particularly bad in the cities because we lived about an hour away from Moscow, and my dad worked in Moscow. So you go into a store in Moscow and it's just, there's nothing there. And I don't think, we didn't have that many deaths from starvation, but there were a lot of second order effects, a lot of alcoholism, suicides, drug use, just people who were extremely depressed because life was terrible. And in the countryside, it was a lot better.
Yep, that's I love that. There's an empirical data point that reinforces my theoretical view. I always like to find those, right? That in a middle tier collapse, life will be better in the countryside.
Yeah.
And so to the degree you can, have some arrangements with people in the countryside. And, you know, if you become two-thirds convinced that the collapse is about to happen, get the fuck out of the big cities, right? Because when the collapse happens, you won't be able to get out.
Yeah, because everybody will be trying to get out.
Yep, exactly, right? And so there, basically, there's your hierarchy, right? And, you know, I will add this as a good American Second Amendment person, you know, make sure you have some guns, right? Particularly if you're in the city, because you may have to fight your way out, or you may have to fight your way to your rural retreat. And your rural retreat obviously needs to be sufficiently well-armed to be able to defend itself, though I would say in if you are able to really think ahead, like I have, we're embedded in a community that is, you know, fairly large and is very capable with guns. And so it would be a community defense of our own periphery, which is about 450 square miles. So in which case, point protection is less important, at least initially, than collective self-defense. In the event of, say, a magnitude 7 or 8 social collapse, where there are indeed gangs of criminals and small-scale warlords, et cetera. And so one must think about that. And I know that's politically incorrect among some correct-thinking people, but, hey, those are going to be the people that are turned into jerky smoked over burning tires. So if you really want to be comprehensive in thinking about your own and your group and your community's redundancy, make sure not only do you have enough weaponry, but that you know how to use it, that you have things like tactical radios, et cetera, to be able to form a local militia to protect your community.
Yeah, interestingly enough, one of the things that was an advantage of being in Russia is that things were fairly low tech at the time. So actually being less technologically advanced was a good thing, because there were things that ran on batteries, like radios. There were a lot of tools that were manual and not digital. They didn't require any kind of like being hooked up to Wi-Fi or anything like that, you know? They just worked independently. So, yeah, a lot of that kind of old school, you know, Russian tech that was built like a tank came in extremely useful.
Yeah, the old Belarus tractors, right? Yeah. Those things, you can't kill them, right? They got no electronics in them at all. Even a massive solar storm or an EMP attack, which fries all modern equipment, would not hurt an old Belarus tractor. That damn thing keep on trucking, right? You know, it's important to have some of that technology available for the recovery. And, you know, and every year that goes by, we are become less and less capable of doing that recovery, particularly in the advanced West. And just, you know, I hate to think about this. Hopefully this is just a goofy scenario. But will the millennials actually go insane if they don't have text messaging, for instance, right? I don't think so.
They might become sober for the first time in their lives.
Yeah. Oh, I also wrote another essay on this topic on cell phones called, what the hell did I call it? Reclaiming Our Cognitive Sovereignty on Medium. And I would advise people, millennials in particular, goddammit, but everybody to read that on how smartphones are unbelievably seductive and program you way more than you program them. So you know, try to get yourself away from that addictive device if you can. And you don't need to. I lay out a whole series of ways that you can replicate almost all the functionality that you actually might like to have without having one of those little devils in your pocket.
Yeah, I think it's become such an integral part of the cognitive operating system of young people that they're actually completely helpless without it. Like, people don't know how to cook without looking up a recipe on their phone. They don't know how to navigate without using Google Maps. They don't know how to, you know, tell time just by looking at the sun. You know, really basic things that, you know, having grown up where I did, those are the kinds of things that you learned.
So yeah, I love that. My father was great at that, and he taught us how to tell time by looking at the sun. My dad was an idiot savant. He could tell the time within 5 minutes by looking at the sun any time of the year. I would say I've never got that good, but I can tell the time within 20 minutes, which is good enough for most practical purposes. But, you know, skills like that are lost, perhaps. Now, I do believe that humans are relatively resilient, and we won't actually have a bunch of zombies walking around like this if the grid goes down, or let's say less severe than the grid is the internet going down, which could happen just by hackers, by the way. As you guys may know, I actually ran some of the core infrastructure for the internet, the domain name system, back in the right at the time of the switch over to the millennium. And there was all these crazy theories about when the years flipped over, all the infrastructure would die. And we were part of the National Critical Infrastructure Task Force. I had people that went to the White House and all that sort of stuff. And while absolutely nothing happened, with today's hackers, it's possible that it could, that the grid doesn't go down, but the internet goes down hard and doesn't come back for a few months. But I don't believe people become zombies. I believe they'll be kind of like, you know, heavy drinkers who stop drinking all of a sudden. They'll go through a couple of weeks of hell, and then they'll be a sort of more or less okay. They'll still be left somewhat damaged from the experience, but they'll be able to get on with life.
I think when the power goes out and you know it's coming back, it's actually a lot of people feel like it's a vacation. You know, the Wi-Fi goes off. Oh, it's like, I can't go on my phone. I can't go on my computer. So people actually have conversations, and they feel like it's actually quite a nice little break.
And certainly I would encourage that hugely. And again, the Game B ethos is to not depend only on weak links. Weak links are weak links. You know, occasionally you can build strong links over time online, but it's the exception, not the rule. Face-to-face, you build strong links more or less instantly. That's what we do, right? We are apes with clothes, right? This cognitive symbolic thing is very late in the day and very relatively light in our actual conscious cognitions. One of the things I've learned in my, how many years now is it, 5-year foray into cognitive science, cognitive neuroscience, is how late and how relatively shallow symbolic cognition is relative to the other part. So get together with people, find your people, find an excuse to get together face to face. And anyone pulls their phone out and starts dealing with it, smack them upside the head and say, that shit ain't allowed, right? We're here to interact human to human and not get seduced by these stupid little devices.
On that note, I think unless you've got any other questions, we can kind of wrap up here.
Well, just is there anything else that we need to talk about to wrap up, to kind of tie it up in a tentative bow at least?
You know, I think we hit on a lot of interesting things. You know, I would say that this is a time when we should, to those of us who are awake, and I'm not going to use the woke term, that's horseshit, but who understand what's going on or trying to reach out and try to hook up with other folks, think good thoughts, read good thinkers. I hope the Game B San Diego tendency will come forth with a manifesto sometime relatively soon. And we'll see if that can serve as a catalyst for what comes next.
Jim, thanks for joining us. This has been fun.
Yeah, really fun.
All righty, guys. This has been fun.
All right.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
All right, that's it for this episode with Jim Rutt. For all the links and show notes from this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/105. Get our 50-page guide on adapting to the future. Sign up at futurethinkers.org/signup.
Upgrade your mental operating system, increase your personal sovereignty, and gain deeper self-knowledge with our courses in personal evolution. Register now at courses.futurethinkers.org.